For our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners, the North Carolina Reading Service provides Indie Week of June the 29th of 2022, and it's read by John Federson. Now, longtime listeners of this program know that our attractive and exciting, sprightly theme music is often provided by various amateur and professional groups to keep it fresh for our audience. Today, I didn't have to do any scrounging around or even phoning. All I had to do was get on the telephone and call one of our North Carolina state agencies. I won't go into which agency it is, but lo and behold, this is their hold music, and it's our fascinating theme song. I find that I am, in fact, on the hold list. I'm caller number 237 in line, so I'll just see. Let's see at the end of our hour broadcast if they're still playing the hold music. And we'll get into our issue then and tune back in to see in an hour. Let's get going with Lena Geller's column called Immaculate Misdirection from Durham. When I ask Wilhelmina Indermauer what she likes about Catholicism, her voice gets breathy and she starts talking at top speed, like she knows she only has so much time to answer the question and wants to pack in as much as she can. She loves attending Mass and describes it as a multisensory, fully immersive experience. The sound of the music, the smell of incense, the taste of communion, the physical movements. Quote, we stand, we sit, we kneel, it's like a dance. She loves the church's ancient rituals, like reciting different prayers at different times of the day, and loves the Catholic devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary. She wears a silver medallion engraved with a venerated saint, and her Instagram bio boasts the Latin phrase totus tuus, which comes from a devotion called the Consecration to the Blessed Virgin Mary, and translates to totally thine. She says, having this maternal energy and this maternal side of what divinity can be is very appealing to me, especially as a trans woman, she says. Indermauer grew up in Raleigh and was raised in the United Methodist Church, but her grandmother, whom she calls Oma, was German Catholic, and she loves how practicing Catholicism makes her feel close to her ancestors. She started attending Catholic Mass regularly during college. She was going through a lot. Her mom was battling uterine cancer. Her Oma had died unexpectedly of ovarian cancer. She had been sexually assaulted multiple times and had come out as gender queer, and she found the church to be a safe place. The Catholic Church generally isn't known for being inclusive, but Indermauer says she always felt accepted as a queer person, then as a queer transgender woman, after she transitioned in 2019. She says, I never felt like the church contradicted who I was. I never felt like I wasn't meant to be there. That changed 2 weeks ago when Indermauer learned that Immaculata Catholic School had prohibited her from working on its campus due to her gender identity. She had been planning to take a role at the K-8 Durham School as an in-class aide for a disabled child whom she nannied through the pandemic. The child, we'll call her Emily, would start school at Immaculata in the fall, so her family had hired Indermauer as an independent contractor. Emily uses a wheelchair and requires assistance with both mobility and communication, so Indermauer would be advocating for her needs, helping her complete schoolwork, eat lunch, and use the bathroom, and taking her from class to class and to appointments with her physical and communicative therapists, whom she meets during the school day. Indermauer seemed like the perfect person for the job. Not only was she familiar with Emily's needs, but she had experience as an educator. She was a preschool teacher for the 3 years before the pandemic, and she was deeply ingrained in the community of both Immaculata and its governing parish, Immaculate Conception. Indemar is registered as a parishioner of a Catholic church in Raleigh, but she's been attending Mass at Immaculata regularly since 2017, when she moved to Durham. She frequently makes solitary visits to pray under the statue of Our Lady of the Immaculate Conception on the church grounds and lights candles in the parish office chapel when she's feeling distressed. In 2020, she took a job nannying two children in a different family than Emily's, who attended Immaculata and has spent the past 2 years accompanying them to the school's Friday morning prayer services, coaching them through religious homework and chatting with their teachers. When Emily's parents offered Indemar the in-class aide position, she was thrilled at the opportunity to work within the community she'd grown to know and love. And until 2 weeks ago, everything seemed set to go. She'd completed the necessary paperwork, passed a background check, and had multiple conversations with parents and teachers who all seemed excited to have her on board then. On June 16, Indemar got a call from Emily's parents. They were crying when she picked up the phone. Jacek Orzechowski, the pastor of Immaculate Conception, had called an emergency meeting earlier in the week between the parish clerical staff and the school's administrative staff, Emily's parents told her. At that meeting, Orzechowski had stated that because Indemar is transgender, she is unfit to work on Immaculate's campus. Immaculata, Immaculate Conception Church, and the Catholic Diocese of Raleigh did not respond to interview requests for this story. Indemar says, "It was devastating. I stayed in bed for a day and a half, and I didn't eat for 2 days." She felt a little better after the third day when she posted about the situation on social media, and messages of support began to come pouring in. But she still felt isolated in her grief. She only knows a few other LGBTQ Catholics, she says, so there weren't many people who could really understand what the loss felt like. She also resented the school for forcing Emily's parents to find a replacement aide last minute, saying, "At first I had a kind of crisis, like, can I even be a Catholic anymore? Can I support being a part of an institution that continues to do all these awful things? But the spirituality is really important to me, and I feel like the church won't change unless people inside of it are working to change it." She decided she would continue to practice Catholicism, but no longer sees herself as part of Immaculata and Immaculate Conception's community. "I don't feel I can go near Immaculata. I've been avoiding driving past it. I don't know if I'll ever feel welcome there again." The day before Indemar found out she'd been barred from working on that campus, the school posted an image of a sunset overlaid with rainbow letters that say, "Remain in my love," on the Instagram account. "Happy Pride Month," reads the caption. "Immaculate Conception welcomes members of the LGBTQ community." 2 days later, the church posted that same text on Twitter and included it in a newsletter to parishioners. While the message seems ironic in the wake of Indemar's experience, it aligns with Immaculate Conception's self-proclaimed commitment to social justice issues. The parish is known for being fairly progressive. It has 5 social action ministry teams, including one that offers a space for support and discussion of sexuality, gender, and spirituality in a loving, non-judgmental faith community. And it's named as one of 4 LGBTQ-friendly parishes in the state of North Carolina by Catholic LGBTQ advocacy group New Ways Ministry. But Indemar is not the first person to throw that label into question. In 2018, Immaculata made national news when it invited then-uninvited openly gay alum and then-Durham City Council member Vernetta Alston to speak as part of the school's Black History Month celebration. Durham City Council member Jillian Johnson, who is queer, also had her invitation rescinded. Christopher Van Heit, the press pastor of Immaculate Conception at the time, said he decided to rescind Alston's invitation after some parents expressed worry that, quote, having a pro-gay marriage politician speak at the school was calling into question the school's commitment to upholding Catholic moral teaching, reported the News and Observer. Van Hite canceled school the day after the rescission, citing possible protests. After receiving backlash from parents and community members, Van Hite re-invited Alston to speak at Immaculate Conception at a later date. Alston was welcomed with a standing ovation when she took the pulpit the next month. Angela Belusic, a teacher's aide at Immaculata who's worked at the school in varying capacities for the past 4 years, says that until 2 weeks ago, she was under the impression that the school had moved past the incident with Alston. When she heard that Indemar had been banned from teaching on the campus, she says it felt like, quote, a smack in the face. Belusic describes Indemar as a present part of our community. She's long seen Indemar at morning prayer services and listened to students gush about her, and she made a point to introduce herself at the end of the school year. I was super excited, she says, to learn that she was going to be at the school. She views Immaculata's rejection of Indemar as a decision made in fear. Quote, what the kids would see is a loving, caring human able to care for another individual, and they would learn from that how to be compassionate humans. This is not teaching them compassion. Belusic says she doesn't believe the decision speaks to the heart of Immaculata, though she can only speculate. She says her gut tells her the ruling came from higher up. There is no explicit stance regarding transgender people in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, though a number of dioceses in the United States have issued policies denying their existence over the past 2 years. And Belusic says, I think, unfortunately, Immaculata is part of a greater system where their hands are tied. Or maybe that's just what she wants to believe, she says. Lila Wolfram, whose daughter recently graduated from Immaculata as school president, says the school frequently credits the diocese with its controversial decisions. But she doesn't think the out-of-our-hands excuse absolves the school of fault. Wolfram says not to use religious language, but that covered a lot of sins for them. I think they were able to express closed-mindedness and worse under that shield. Wolfram wasn't aware of Indemar's rejection until I told her about it. But she says that if the diocese is indeed behind it, it's disturbing that the school didn't push back more. Quote, the idea that the diocese could make a decision like that and that the community wouldn't stand up for her is astonishing to me. Belusic was the only teacher I could find who agreed to go on the record, though another teacher told me that much of the faculty is upset about Indemar's treatment. Belusic was raised Catholic but no longer identifies with the denomination. There's too much she disagrees with, she says, and currently attends services at Duke Memorial United Methodist Church in Durham. She recognizes that speaking out against her employer may cost her her job, but she wants to exhibit the same courage that Duke Memorial pastor Heather Rodriguez showed when she first consummated a marriage between a same-sex couple within the walls of the church. The day after our interview, Belusic asked if she could call me back with something that had kept her up during the night. When I answered the phone, she was crying. She says, to those who have been beaten down and traumatized by religion and threatened in the face of hate through Christ and through religion, I want to say there are people who don't believe that that is our Christ. Our Christ would welcome Wilhelmina at the table. The same-sex couple who are the parents of one of my students would be at that table. And the hate would not be welcome at the table. Now, Sarah Edwards, from, again, reporting from Durham, another religious-related article, Separation of Church. On Saturdays, for the past few months, a small group of protesters gather in Durham holding signs that read things like, Keep Durham Queer, and You Can't Nuance Your Way Out of Homophobia. The organization they're protesting, Pioneers Durham, is a hybrid church/business run by Pastor Sheree Lopez Jackson. I reported on Pioneers when it first opened last November and began to receive community pushback for its stance on LGBTQ inclusion, about which it initially demurred, though Lopez Jackson eventually admitted that she will not marry queer couples, but says they are welcome at the church, among other things. Since then, the pushback has amplified, forcing the United Methodist Church, UMC, with which the church had been affiliated, to step in and respond to the criticism, and more recently causing the church to disaffiliate entirely from that denomination. But first, the real estate space. Pioneers is located on West Gear Street, a highly sought-after property in downtown Durham. Immaculately bright and white, the shop has the spacious feel of an Apple store or West Elm showroom. Sometimes there are people inside. Per its website, the space operates as a, quote, innovative, redemptive enterprise. And inside, you can purchase tea and items by local artists, soap, candles, uplifting greeting cards, or use it as a co-working space. On the weekends, the space will eventually flip into a church. Lopez Jackson also recently announced plans to open up space for childcare. It is this slippery blend of church and commerce, paired with an evasive communication style, outreach contoured around affluent New Durham populations. The Pioneer's Instagram account often includes a string of hashtags for nearby luxury condos, and the non-affirming stance on LGBTQ issues that has spurred controversy. For a while, across the street, Motoko Music Hall, which faces Pioneers, hung large banners quoting LGBTQ activities and rainbow flags dotted Gear Street. A petition condemning the church accrued more than 7,500 signatures. Motoko hosted a well-attended community forum about the church, and the Google Maps page of Pioneers was swamped with one-star reviews, though there has also been an influx of five-star reviews. Since late November, the satirical Instagram account at Real Native Church has maintained a prolific posting schedule and appointed sepia-toned caricature of Pioneer. In March, a group of local UMC pastors penned an open letter to regional leadership denouncing Pioneers and asking the UMC to cut financial ties with it. The letter stated, United Methodists criticize Pioneer's brand-first approach to community building and are wary of the church's opaque relationship to a for-profit business sponsored by the annual conference. In response to each of these charges, Pioneer's has remained silent or recommitted to the practice that originated the concern. We stand with those who say that the broken trust between Pioneer's and the people of Durham is beyond repair. The tension may be local, but it has also crept into broader discussions about the direction of the UMC with which Pioneers is affiliated, or was affiliated with at least. On June 5th, Lopez Jackson's husband, Daniel Jackson, head pastor at downtown Durham's Trinity United Methodist Church, stood up in the pulpit and announced to the congregation he would leave his post and join his wife as co-pastors at Pioneers. He said, "Now is the right season for my transition. A part of this transition, on a practical note, is Pioneers changing from a United Methodist Church to a Wesleyan Church. The Wesleyan Church denomination is a historic sister church of UMC that was launched as an abolition movement coming out of the main Methodist branch." To a congregant sitting in a church pew, this announcement may have seemed out of the blue, especially since Lopez Jackson had written a letter to Trinity less than 2 months before, thanking the church for its support of Pioneers and spelling out hopes for the future. But around the time of that letter, the North Carolina Conference, the regional umbrella leadership of UMC, also made Pioneers halt services, according to local UMC pastor Heather Rodriguez, as part of ongoing mediation between the church and other LGBTQ-affirming Methodist pastors. Pioneers then announced it was leaving UMC. As Daniel Jackson said from the pulpit, the Wesleyan Church has a progressive history. rooted in the teachings of John Wesley, the denomination broke off from the larger UMC in 1843 and went on to elevate abolitionist and feminist principle. But if its history is more progressive than its UMC's counterparts in the present day, it toes a much harder line on other social issues, including, notably, LGBTQ rights. The Wesleyan website reads, quote, "We adhere to the teachings of Scripture regarding gender identity, sexual conduct, and the sacredness of marriage, and believe that sexual relationships outside of marriage and sexual relationships between the persons of the same sex are immoral and sinful." When asked for an interview about this sudden denominational shift, Lopez Jackson declined to interview or comment for this follow-up story, though she sent two emails, both labeled off the record, in which she asked me not to write one. Over the past few months, though, Indie Week has received an outpouring of comments from readers who feel a vested interest in the future of this space and its stake in a changing city. Much of denominational inner workings, the way language is chosen, the way conferences and committees are structured, the way church finances are handled, can feel like religious inside baseball. But religion itself and the way it functions inside a community is profoundly personal. It should also be profoundly public. In 1832, 11 years before the Wesleyan Church was founded, a small congregation of 30, the first Methodist group in the area, began meeting at a small schoolhouse a mile east of Durham. This was the beginning of Trinity United Methodist, which now meets in a large Gothic steepled structure on the corner of Liberty and North Church Streets, overlooking City Hall. For years, it has hung rainbow banners outside its gates and spelled out a message of inclusivity in its church bulletin. As the Indy previously reported, the UMC at large has been inching toward a split over LGBTQ issues. In March, that split became further realized when the UMC announced it was postponing its 2022 General Conference, originally scheduled for 2020, and at which church leaders were expected to vote on a split until 2024. In May, the conservative faction of the church decided it could wait no longer and launched the global United Methodist Church. It's not as if the friction within UMC, or the friction between pioneers and community members, for that matter, exists in a vacuum. Increasingly, LGBTQ rights are coming under vehement attack, and just last week, in a solo concurring opinion regarding the overturning of Roe v. Wade, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote that the court should reconsider Griswold, Lawrence, and Obergefell, three rulings that protect contraception, same-sex relationship, and same-sex marriage. But while many churches may be conflicted about their stance on inclusion, in Durham, Trinity United Methodist has not appeared to be one such institution. This made the 2020 pastoral appointment of Daniel Jackson, a freshly minted Duke Divinity graduate, all the more puzzling to some members of Trinity's congregation. Alice Stone, a lifelong Methodist, was one such Trinity congregant. When she learned of Jackson's appointment during the early pandemic, she signed up for one of the virtual coffees he offered and was excited to learn that he shared a vision of young adult outreach with her. Several months later, she received a Facebook notification from Jackson's wife, Sherry Lopez Jackson, inviting her to like the Pioneers page. This came to a surprise to her. It was the first time she was learning of a new church plant, which struck her as odd given Trinity's implicit relationship with it. Stone says, "My original frustration is that the information that I was getting was not coming from the pulpit or from congregational meetings or from any of that. It was social media. Recognizing that our population is largely older and not really on social media, I then had concerns about what was happening, what the congregation knew and didn't know, and what was kind of being decided on their behalf." Community outreach is normally the first step when the UMC decides to open and support a new church. But in this case, Stone wasn't alone in being in the dark. Other local UMC churches, some just a few blocks away, had not been aware of the new church. Stone says she contacted UMC's staff parish relations committee with questions and was encouraged to reach out directly to Jackson with concerns. This wasn't exactly standard procedure, but Stone approached Jackson anyway with questions about Trinity's involvement in Pioneers. Shortly thereafter, Stone says, Lopez Jackson blocked her from accessing Pioneer's Facebook page. Frustrated at the lack of transparency, Stone and her husband left Trinity. They have not rejoined a United Methodist Church since. Of course, there are other businesses and churches in Durham that are homophobic. Plenty of residents are, too. When Amendment 1, a referendum to the state constitution banning same-sex marriages, passed in 2012, as many as 30% of Durhamites voted in support of it. Pioneers is not alone in its theology. Despite, or perhaps because of this, opponents of Pioneers believe it still needs to be held to task. Natalie Spring is the mother of two school-aged children, one of whom is queer. She walks past Pioneers often. Her mistrust of it, she says, is in part its lack of transparency about its belief. She also feels it stands for other lurking prejudices. She says, it's not a capital C church, right? It's a social enterprise. A lot of straight people just kind of forget because, like, oh, Durham is perfect. Durham is great. And it's not. In some ways, this is a reminder to people we don't live in a bubble in Durham. Everything is not for everyone. Here is a manifestation of that. Jesse Huddleston, a director of music ministry at City Well United Methodist Church and co-chair of the Pride NC Steering Committee, says that, among other things, they're disappointed by the way Pioneers has responded to conflict. Quote, more than my disappointment is learning that they weren't affirming. I really felt disappointed by the way they were responding to community members. There wasn't a sincere openness to equitable, real, authentic conversation. You'll find scant evidence of this conflict on the Pioneers website and social media pages. Offline, Pioneers engagement has also ping-ponged. According to local resident Caleb Parker, who is Methodist and married his husband in 2020 at a local Methodist church, at some protests, Lopez Jackson would sit outside the church with baked goods and a sign encouraging people to come talk to her. At other points, she blocked local queer residents from the business's Instagram account, on which comments are already disabled. The church also did not engage with a list of questions I emailed over, including a request for the name that the business is registered under, which the Indy was unable to locate online, and for a copy of the church's most recent 990. A copy of the church's most recent 990, which is supposed to be publicly available. Lopez Jackson also responded no comment to my query about whether it was true, as rumor has it that she and Daniel Jackson traveled to Waco, Texas, to seek guidance from home renovation television stars Chip and Joanna Gaines, who have drawn criticism for attending a megachurch led by a pastor adamant that same-sex marriage is a sin. In November, when I spoke to Lopez Jackson, she told me that the church and business have different tax status, but it's unclear where the organization's business designation lives online. In both reporting of this and the previous piece, Mark Hutchins, landlord of 408 West Gear Street, did not return calls from Indy inquiring more details about the lease. And so, Pioneers has chugged along, slowly forming a quiet presence on Gear Street. There are occasional events, a Juneteenth celebration, a series of co-working lunches, and recently a book launch from the writer Jonathan Martin that, according to the event description, centers on religious trauma and, quote, disentangling the good news of the gospel from the toxic theologies that have rendered Jesus unrecognizable, unquote. Weeks ago, Before Pioneers announced its disaffiliation, community organizers had planned a reparative meeting with UMC leaders, including Bishop Leonard Fairley, resident bishop of the North Carolina Conference, hoping for the denomination's leadership to take responsibility for its unquestioning support in launching the church. When Pioneers shifted to the Wesleyan Church, organizers decided to continue with the meeting regardless on June 21. I did not attend. Media was asked not to. But reportedly about 50 people showed up, and Huddleston told me they believed that leadership was, quote, sincere in their lament over how things had transpired. To be clear, the UMC, on paper, is still not an affirming denomination. And Fairley also declined to comment for this story, except to say he was looking forward to working with area clergy to, quote, address the harm. Still, it seems like change is afoot. I don't think this could have happened 15 years ago, said Caleb Parker, in reference to the forum which he helped organize. We've come a long way. Also, to be clear, although Pioneers has switched denomination affiliation, local organizers still very much want the organization to leave. Parker says, our last question to UMC leadership was, do you still believe it's your responsibility for the Methodists to get Pioneers out? And they said yes, they feel that is their responsibility. Natalie Spring walked away from the meeting hopeful that Pioneers' new denomination will at the very least force the church to be more explicit about its beliefs. I own my beliefs, says Spring. I would like them to own theirs and see if it's profitable. And if it's not, maybe that becomes a story too. They tried to have a church in the middle of a queer neighborhood that wasn't affirming, that was overtly anti-gay. And this is what happened. Our next article by Hannah Kaufman and Mariana Fabian, titled Marijuana Mayhem, is in the print issue. There's also articles online, but neither of those articles are as up-to-date as a couple of very recent processes that have just occurred in the legislature. But I'll read the article. There's a lot of detail in it, and I will say at the end, I'll say right now, that Senate Bill 455, which you'll hear more about, has passed the Senate, the North Carolina Senate, and could go to Governor Cooper for signature. He hasn't said whether he'd sign it or not. And that vote was like 43-2 or something. So, marijuana mayhem. Pardon me. There's a growing industry here in North Carolina, and with it comes countless rules, gray areas, and legal confusion. And no, we're not talking about NFTs. The hemp industry has been blooming in the state for years, but North Carolina is one of 12 states that doesn't have a medical marijuana program. With the end of the legislative session on Thursday, that's today when I'm reading this story, and with it the sunset of the state's 2017 industrial hemp pilot program legalizing hemp, CBD, and Delta 8 products for sale here, we're left puzzling over a number of bills sitting in the General Assembly, some of which could help patients who desperately need access to medical marijuana, and some of which could hurt local hemp farmers and business owners who have built their lives around the industry. North Carolina is far ahead in the hemp game, but far behind in legalization, putting the local industry at a disadvantage, says Gabrielle Gerrell, a chair at NC Normal. That's an organization that advocates for decriminalization and legalization of weed. Quote, there's lots and lots of hemp farmers in North Carolina. We have a phenomenal climate for growing hemp, so it's become a blossoming industry, especially out west. But it's an industry that's been hit hard. There were 1,500 hemp farmers in 2020. Now there's only 360 remaining. But those 360 farmers include only those whose hemp farms are officially registered with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. In January, the USDA took direct oversight of all hemp cultivation in the state. Farmers weren't pleased with this development, says Sarah Carson, the fundraising chair at NC Normal. Quote, a lot of farmers have private farms, and when the USDA comes in, You have to give them open access anytime they want. They can come to your farm, inspect your crop, do all those things that farmers are like, whoa, I don't want to be a part of this. There are still many more active hemp farmers in the state, many of whom likely don't know they were supposed to register with USDA or are waiting to see the future of the hemp industry here before they register, says Nicolette Baglio, a cannabis policy advocate and hemp entrepreneur. Another reason the industry is in flux right now is the uncertainty of medical marijuana legality. There are several cannabis-related bills in the state legislature. One of those is Senate Bill 1711, or the NC Compassionate Care Act, currently awaiting a vote in the state House. Axios reported the House Republicans voted internally last week not to advance the bill. But even if it doesn't pass this session, it's likely it will be pushed through soon, given public support to pass the Republican-led bill while the party controls both chambers of the General Assembly, says Baglio. What is SB 711? It would set up a restrictive medical marijuana program in North Carolina, granting 10 medical cannabis supplier licenses for companies to apply for in the state. The Medical Cannabis Production Commission, which is established in the bill, would decide on 10 companies out of 20 recommended applicants chosen by the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Baglio says this bill would create a very limited, unprofitable structure that doesn't benefit the majority of North Carolina's patients. Baglio says, not only are the license structures incredibly limited, that's 10 licenses that would get to operate 80 dispensaries, but the patient access list is so small that it really only covers between 3 and 5% of North Carolinians that would even qualify, so it just doesn't make sense. The math doesn't math, is what we like to say. But here's the bill's main catch. Each license costs $50,000. And the bill requires proof that each applicant will be able to operate as a supplier for 2 years in the form of liquid and non-liquid assets, which could be difficult for local startups and small business owners. The bill also mandates that each company has someone on board with prior operation experience of cultivation, production, and management of cannabis products in a state-licensed medical or adult-use cannabis operation, neither of which have ever been legal in North Carolina. Morgan Davis, a cannabis business lawyer based in Raleigh, says the bill, quote, requires that the company prove they have a consultant or an investor or someone who's been involved in the medical marijuana industry before, which necessarily requires that they're going to have to go out of state because obviously no one in North Carolina has been involved in that industry in the last 5 years, not legally anyway. Even if a North Carolina business does have experience growing, says Carson, announcing it to the government would instantly put a target on their back. Quote, you're going to be looked at like, why do you have experience growing? A lot of people are just like, why am I going to incriminate myself? Because local cannabis business would have a difficult time participating in Senate Bill 711, medical marijuana program, the bill opens the door to huge cannabis companies called multi-state operators, MSOs, to come in from other states where medical marijuana is legal and monopolize North Carolina's industry, says Carson. Quote, if a business is a multi-million-dollar business, they could buy 5 of those licenses and own half the market in this state. That's really not fair, says Carson, and that's what a lot of these businesses are looking at. Several MSOs are waiting to jump in the moment SB 711 passes, including Cresco Labs, Jushi Holdings, and Trulieve, the largest medical marijuana company in Florida. Trulieve and Merida Capital, the private equity firm behind Cresco and Jushi, hired state lobbyists shortly after the bill was introduced last year, says Baglio. Quote, one of the reasons that North Carolina is so confusing is that we actually built a bustling hemp industry before. We're late to the legislation game, the legalization game, excuse me. And so why would these incoming MSOs want to play nice and say, you guys keep that, we'll do this? They're not. They're being like, great, we'll take it all, thanks. But Baglio says there is still hope for local hemp farmers. Most of the major MSOs, including Cresco and Jushi, reported declines in revenue in the first quarter of 2022 compared to the previous quarter. Baglio says these declines were driven by discerning consumers. She compares the cannabis industry to another popular industry in the state, craft beer. Baglio says you're starting to really see that nobody's going to want your Walmart cannabis. As the customer is getting more knowledgeable and more sophisticated, they don't want Sam's Club. They don't want Walmart cannabis. They want craft beer, craft cannabis. They want to buy local and from someone they can trust. But unless another bill is passed quickly, North Carolina's whole hemp industry, as it currently operates, is under threat. The state's 2017 industrial hemp pilot program is set to expire June the 30th. That's in one day. And even though hemp is legal and off the controlled substance list under the federal 2018 Farm Bill, North Carolina lawmakers have so far chosen not to address the program, leaving no state protections for hemp after June 30th, unless a new bill is passed this week. Senate Bill 762 was originally the champion bill for farmers, but after it was stripped last week of language protecting hemp in its most recent version, there are now two other bills that could benefit the hemp industry if passed this session: House Bill 1051 and Senate Bill 455. Both have the goal of conforming the state's hemp laws to match federal hemp laws, but SB 455 would permanently exclude hemp from the state's Controlled Substance Act and is the furthest along of any of the bills. Versions of the bill passed both state Senate and House, but its current iteration is awaiting a Senate committee hearing. Baglio says Senate 455 is actually the closest to touchdown in our opinion. The Senate could vote on the bill and have it on Governor Cooper's desk in an hour, and they're unwilling to do it. If lawmakers don't make any moves on this bill or any others by Thursday, all hemp products will become illegal in the state on Friday. While hemp growers with a USDA license are safe, businesses involved in retail side lose all protection. Baglio says it essentially criminalizes an entire industry of CBD and Delta 8 manufacturers, retailers, growers, processors, so we hope that doesn't happen. And obviously, if no hemp bill is passed and the provisions expire, it's just going to create a very confusing gray area of what's legal and what's not. Even though all we've really been asking for is to operate under the federal farm bill. Grace Holtkamp owns Mary Hill Hemp, an organic CBD hemp farm in Mebane, created in 2017. It was the first farm in the country to run a pick-your-own hemp season, an annual tradition that was created to destigmatize cannabis. Holtkamp says, I have a USDA hemp license because I'm required to, so I can still grow, but I cannot sell to my own home state. And as a farm that's dedicated to local community and dependent on local community, that's not only unfair, it's nonsensical. Furthermore, Holtkamp says farmers are attempting to understand the chaos and confusion of these bills at the same time they are investing their livelihood in their plants for another year of growing, as hemp growers need to get their crop in the ground by mid to late June. So, Holtkamp says, if you have people like us who have just planted hundreds, if not thousands, of plants, and now this legalization has suddenly taken this U-turn, it's very daunting. What does it mean for the hemp industry? John Bocella, co-owner of the hemp company, a family-owned store in Raleigh, says he's fighting hard to hold on to their right to sell their products. He says, I feel an obligation for advocacy. The hemp company is a family business for us. Two of my three boys work at the hemp company, and it's really important to us as a family business. It's also really important to the relationships that we've built with our customers in the community. I've been focusing very much on getting the hemp laws restored back in the state. Pochella says that the SB 711 was not created for the benefit of hemp farmers and companies based in North Carolina. He also emphasized that North Carolina has the capacity to benefit from all of this. Quote, "It's important that the state's benefits, and when I say the state, I mean in revenue tax dollars. They can benefit as well, the North Carolina farms, manufacturers, retailers, families that are North Carolina residents, versus these giant corporations that are outside and not even registered to the state of North Carolina. With SB 455 languishing, lawmakers seem to have little urgency in renewing hemp provisions before they expire," says Baglio, the hemp entrepreneur. Baglio, among other business owners, has also put pressure on Cooper to issue an executive order protecting hemp, but she says Cooper hasn't made any indications that he will do so. Baglio says, "We, as North Carolinians, have always embraced and supported our small businesses and farmers. So I think it's pretty shocking to see the legislators turning their backs on this industry." And as I mentioned, I will turn to the Raleigh News and Observer as a column that was just written that says, "North Carolina's legislatures approved a bill legalizing the production and sale of hemp. Bill now goes to Governor Cooper, who hasn't said whether he'll sign it. That was 41-2 by the state Senate to pass Senate Bill 455. So, obviously, stay tuned. I'll continue now from IndieWeek.com, which has a couple of articles not included in the print version that I've been referring to. Durham Public Schools votes to keep dual language program at Lakewood and Bethesda, written by Carol Jane. Last week, the Durham County School Board voted unanimously to keep the Spanish-English dual language programs offered at Lakewood and Bethesda elementary schools, following weeks of parents and advocates calling for that program to continue. Because Durham Public School, DPS, is in the middle of system-wide redistricting, the school board's plan was to remove the program from Lakewood and Bethesda and relocate it to the larger Southwest Elementary following redistricting process. But many parents found issues with that program leaving those schools, especially since both programs haven't even finished their original six-year runtime with the program. Martin Rigsdale, the parent of a student at Lakewood, said during a May 31st public hearing, "Over the past 3 years, we've witnessed an incredible amount of passion and work going into making this program a success. Despite all the obstacles caused by remote school, learning a language while masked, etc. And now that it's finally starting to feel established and settled, to hear that it might be dismantled is incredibly disheartening." Lakewood and Bethesda are considered Title I schools, meaning both schools receive federal funding to help low-income students academically excel. At Lakewood Elementary, over 50% of the student population is Hispanic, and at Bethesda, the Hispanic population is approximately 35%. Both schools started their dual-language programs in the 2019-20 school year, after the Durham School Board voted to approve that program in April of 2019. Angela Duran, the parent of a student at Lakewood, said during that public hearing meeting, "The vast majority of Hispanic students enrolled at Lakewood come from families of low educational and socioeconomic status who do not speak English. The dual program has given those families the opportunity to send their children to school without the fear of language barriers and racial discrimination, as well as the confidence to communicate with the people who care for their children 7 hours a day, 5 days a week." Pascal Mubenga, superintendent at Durham Public School, said the Durham Board of Education initially oversimplified the dual language program schools as similar to magnet programs, where students from all across the district may apply to access the program. However, Mubenga said neither Lakewood nor Bethesda are magnet schools, and the DLI program for both schools are designed and implemented for those particular school population. at the June 23rd meeting when the board approved continuing that program at the two schools, Movenga said Lakewood and Bethesda can choose to continue their dual language programs based on available demand and resources. And in response, the DPS board has opened 5 regional dual language program applications for Durham Public Schools to apply to. Mubinga said, I hope this has been able to clarify the misunderstanding we had. We had a lot of parents and advocates who came to speak to our board. Lena Geller, again from reporting from Durham. ShotSpotter article. ShotSpotter has implemented its technology in more than 130 cities over the past 25 years and has faced harsh criticism in cities like Chicago, where police shot and killed a 13-year-old boy after responding to a ShotSpotter alert, and Charlotte, where officials described the software as overpriced and ineffective. Community discussion this week on Durham's forthcoming gunshot detection pilot program began with a moment of silence, led by Mayor Elaine O'Neill to mourn the 2 Bull City residents who were shot and killed over the weekend. After reminding 70-odd attendees at Monday's meeting that solving Durham's gun violence is going to take us all, O'Neill excused herself to go to a funeral, her second of the week, she said. Many echoed O'Neill's call for community collaboration during the remainder of that 2-hour meeting, where Mayor Pro Tem Mark Anthony Middleton hosted at St. Joseph AME Church as an opportunity for residents to ask questions to and seek assurances from ShotSpotter CEO Ralph Clark. ShotSpotter uses hidden microphone sensors that alert law enforcement of the precise location where a shot was fired within a moment's notice, according to Clark. The technology aims to save the lives of shooting victims by helping first responders get to the scene more quickly, particularly in areas where residents are so desensitized to gun violence or so distrusting of the police they don't bother calling 911, as well as to aid law enforcement in evidence collection and arrests by narrowing search areas. Now, as I said, the company, which is implemented in more than 130 cities over 25 years, has faced harsh criticism in Chicago and Charlotte. The technology has also been controversial among members of the Durham City Council. Council member Jillian Johnson had previously told the Indy that ShotSpotter is primarily effective at, quote, manufacturing consent for increased policing, suggesting gun control, affordable housing, and a guaranteed living wage as alternatives. Councilmember Javier Caballero and former councilmember Charlie Reese also shared concern, but they were ultimately outweighed by Middleton, O'Neill, and councilmembers Leonardo Williams and Dedrina Freeman, who in March voted to bring ShotSpotter to Durham as a year-long $200,000 pilot program. Monique Holsey-Hyman, whom the council recently appointed to fill Reese's vacant seat, has also voiced support for the program. And Middleton said, I made a commitment to the people of Durham that if we were to go down this path, I would invite the CEOs of ShotSpotter to come and face the music, because this is Durham, and the music is loud. The music at Monday night's meeting seemed to play at a more moderate volume than Middleton expected. There were some inbox gangsters and Twitter figures who were noticeably absent, she said. Though the first resident to take the stand, an older gentleman bearing an American flag pattern folder full of notes, was visibly agitated. He asked Clark, how liable will your company be when your technology fails and someone gets killed? It was unclear whether that someone would be an unarmed person or child shot by police, as happened in Chicago, or a shooting victim gone unsaved in the event that the technology is less effective than advertised. Clark responded, ShotSpotter in and of itself is not a panacea to prevent or reduce gun violence. It's a tool that hopefully being used with other tools as part of a comprehensive strategy to help police departments deal with the issue of gun violence. more than 80% of shootings are not reported to 9/11, Clark added, referencing a 2016 study that used ShotSpotter data. Other attendees were more specific in their inquiries. One woman, Valerie Valentine, asked whether there will be metrics to evaluate the effectiveness of the pilot and also wondered where the sensors will be installed. Will they be equitably distributed around the city? Middleton replied, the location of the sensors is still confidential. At some point, the police department will unveil that information. As for metrics, Middleton said that if ShotSpotter is able to save even one Durham resident's life, that's enough justification for him. Another woman who used her phone to live stream the entirety of the meeting on Instagram asked whether community members would receive a ShotSpotter notifications in the event that a shooting takes place in a neighborhood. She asked, you're warning the police department. Shouldn't the community be warned also? Clark replied, the company is not yet disseminating alerts to the community on a real-time basis, though subscribing agencies are encouraged to aggregate data and report back to the public using an open portal. The woman also noted instances where her neighbors have called 9/11 and first responders didn't show up. She asked, if we're getting this type of response from 9/11 now, how do we know the police officers are going to show up? Middleton acknowledged that Durham Police has had staffing issues, but assured the audience, we're starting to see improvements to lateral entry hire, thanks to a recently passed pay raise for officers. And, well, I see, even though I have not completed reading this article, that my time is expiring to get it all done. I'm just checking. Oh, listen to that. I'm still on hold. I haven't checked my availability on the phone response from this bureau, North Carolina office I'm attempting to phone. But in any event, I'm John Federson, reminding you that Indie Week and IndieWeek.com is available for the remainder of this week as a podcast at the podcast section. And I will see you, or I won't see you at all. You'll hear me again next week as we get into July, reminding you all that over in Durham, the 4th of July now has the festival at the Eno, a huge, huge event that's going to look like it's going to have favorable weather. And if you're not doing anything on the, over the 4th, Saturday and Monday are those days for festival at the Eno River. And I will just let myself stay on and wish me luck. Maybe by next week I'll have gotten through to this office. John Federson for Indie Week, saying so long.